today we focus on the precautions that we have to take with a foundation, with your private foundation. Let's just start with a tiny preamble. The preamble is the following. One of the greatest gifts the IRS gives us is the opportunity to make a charitable gift rather than just to the charity, but to an entity that we own as a family, and that's why you're on this call today, because you've created one, an entity owned by the family where the family has its own trustees and can receive this financial gift, and there will be a tax deduction for the donor, and these assets will now grow inside the foundation without any taxation, with the very comparatively small obligation of making a 5% distribution on an annual basis. With all the high quality financial advisors we have, it's not unusual to hear that the foundations are outperforming the 5%. So when a foundation is doing that, then in fact the foundation is growing, or maybe at least tracking inflationary numbers, and so distributions from the foundation have no real impact on evaporating the overall principal. And maybe there is even a compounding effect of what's taking place. With that great gift, the IRS does not want us to abuse it. And abuse comes when you fail to keep the foundation in compliance with annual reports, when you fail to understand that many people who create foundations also have their own family office, when you start to share services with your family office and somehow there's an undue benefit to the family office that the foundation is paying out of its tax-free dollars, when certain people who are related to the foundation are receiving certain benefits where maybe they're providing janitorial services because they own a cleaning company to the foundation, which is nothing unique and special, and that would be disallowed. When there are certain investments that would give benefits to foundation members, or certain events that the foundation would pay for, and non-exclusive parties or excluded parties are using those events to attend, paid by the foundation. Our view here is this is a very nuanced area, and it is critical to stay on track with this. This call is to provide a highlight, very briefly, on what the essential aspects are. Always stay in touch with us. We're going to post the list of traps for each of you on our website after this is completed. We've also reached out to you individually and indicated for those who have created the foundations already that this is a good recording to listen to on our website. So with that, I want to thank Amelia McManus, who spent her summer interning with us and researching the key aspects of foundation compliance, which we picked up from our Heckeling Institute this past winter, and for Carol Molnar, who a trusted associate here at the firm who provided an added life with examples of when you're off track. And so with that, and without further ado, let's move forward on the key pieces. Number one, self-improvement is fine. Self-dealing is not. So use caution when compensating family members to the foundation because of the self-dealing prohibitions. What is self-dealing? So in your head, board members, and of course you're that, officers, which you can be as well, family members have to avoid financial transactions with the foundation. Certain transactions between the foundation and a disqualified person are subject to self-dealing rules. Who, again, are are disqualified, officers and members of the foundation board, substantial contributors to the foundation, foundation managers, and family members described above. That is the key group, and you should identify them for yourselves by name and be real clear as to whether or not you're in compliance. So, for example, the sale or exchange of property or leasing property, even to the terms even though the terms are favorable to the foundation, could be deemed to be self-dealing. So this occurs when a disqualified person buys foundation property from an agent from the foundation. For example, if artwork is assigned by a foundation to an art auction and the purchaser of the artwork at the auction would be considered self-dealing if they were disqualified individual, lending money or other extensions of credit, either way, to the foundation or from the foundation, providing goods, services, or facilities. Before, we spoke about having a cleaning company. Nothing unique about that that would require that the foundation would be entitled to use the particular cleaning company that was owned by the family, or paying compensation or reimbursing expenses for a disqualified person. So keep in mind here, for example, even the transfer of assets and having a foundation member having an account, for example, at a management company and paying a 1% management fee, but now that the foundation moved its assets to that company, the aggregation of total assets brought the management fee down to 5%. Well, that board member was unjustly enriched because that board member got a break on its fees because the foundation was added to the total amount under management. So that would be an example of self-dealing. Very subtle, but nonetheless, a benefit for the board member and viewed as disallowed. That said, there are exceptions. So certain personal services that are reasonable and necessary to carry out the foundation's purposes, you can then be exempt from the disqualified person exception. So what is personal service? Of course, it could be administrative support, real estate management, investment management, legal and accounting services, but not secretarial. It is too standard, and frankly, the way they look at it, like any kind of janitorial, would be viewed as something that anyone could provide, and there was no unique skill set that was necessary, and therefore that would be disallowed. But attorneys and accountants who are family members and that are on the foundation board, they can provide the legal services. And there is a case, Madison versus the commissioner, which is 20 years old, that has stood the test of time. To further what qualifies as a disqualified person can provide a service is lease negotiations, management of debt and budgeting and accounting, supervision of property and operations. So again, specialized services where a disqualified member can serve because of the uniqueness of the work. So Mary Olson, for our example one, Mary Olson created the Olson Family Foundation with a $5 million gift and is now contributing an additional $10 million to the foundation for the sale of her business. She realizes that with the increased assets, there's going to be additional administrative and managerial needs. Therefore, she asks her good son, Ben, to serve as the director of programs at the foundation. After reviewing the staffing models at other foundations with assets in similar ranges, the foundation board determined that Ben's salary would be $60,000 a year based on a 35-hour work week. So the key thing here is, number one, the employee, family member, would otherwise be disqualified. But in this instance, he was doing unique work. There was a review and a study of other staffing models. So to have a basis and a benchmark for, what is appropriate in the compensation industry here, and having the full board approve the salary and approve the scope of the employee's position. So in this instance, the disallowed person would now be able to qualify as an employee. So the payment of the salary is valid and fair, and that we would recommend that Ben keep a record of his hours and the services in the event of an audit going forward. Okay, number two, self-dealing is bad, but frankly the penalties are worse. So a foundation does not pay self-dealing taxes. It is the person who participates in the act that pays the initial tax of 10%. According to the IRS, self-dealing taxes can be abated for reasonable cause. This is an important point because it means that self-dealing issues must be taken seriously, and of course, the rules follow carefully. Counsel can be expensive in this instance. So the first tier tax on self-dealing is 10%, assessed on the amount that is involved, and will be imposed on the disqualified person. So you are the family member on the board, and you got the payment for compensation for janitorial, or your wife was the, or husband was the secretary. In that instance, that would there would be a 10% excise tax or penalty on that person for for that piece. There's also a 5% tax imposed on the foundation manager who knowingly and willingly participated. They want to get individuals in the pocket. Why should the foundation be penalized when its notion is for charitable benefits? It should be the individuals behind the foundation, is the IRS's view. There can be a second-tier tax of 200% of an amount involved on the disqualified person if there is a failure to timely correct the self-dealing. So timely has a lot to do with, well, when did you find out that you made this mistake? Or had there been any advice that you sought that you should have had knowledge or forethought, as we say in law school, in advance, or you should have compelled you to seek advice on this? And then once you established that, how quickly did you move to stay in line? So staying focused with us in your foundation and having us answer questions as we move forward on these and your foundation becomes more involved would be critical so that we can serve to remedy and rectify pieces afterwards. The subsequent remedial measures will go primarily to the leniency that we're asking the IRS for with respect to transgressions. We can share, but not too much. Number three. So follow the guidelines for sharing office space, equipment, and personnel with the family office. The idea here is that you have this wonderful goose that is laying the golden tax-free egg on an annual basis, right? Well, maybe it's making money because there's no taxation. So wouldn't it be nice to have them share in the expenses that your family office has? Wouldn't it be awesome if they had took 2,500 square feet and built out their space or contributed to the building out of joint space? Well, all good and fine, except the IRS looks at this and says, we're going to presume upfront that you have not negotiated a fair deal, so that will be for the foundation, and so therefore we're going to penalize you upfront. You can get around this by having a separate lease directly with the landlord. So this shows that you have a business situation. But you may have common area with your family office. And common area may mean you share a hallway or a conference room or a kitchen. In those instances, the conservative approach, at minimum, should be the family office should pick up all the expenses connected with the common area of the space between the foundation and the family office. If separate offices and leases are not a viable approach, the family office should sign a lease to allow the foundation to utilize any space that is shared free. Renting to a foundation is not considered self-dealing if it is free. The lease is considered to be without charge if the foundation pays for its own utilities and other maintenance. So those are where areas where the foundation can pick up a portion of the expenses, which would otherwise be picked up by the family office, but the rent is the primary driver, and that would be paid by the family office if there was common area that was shared. Similarly, when we deal with equipment and supplies, the family office can enter into separate contracts with a third party to provide the necessary equipment and supplies. If the technology infrastructure cannot be divided between the two entities, the family office must pay the expenses. Okay? So when in doubt, have the family office pay. When in doubt, reach us. When we go through it, we're going to always veer to having the family office pay. We have this goose that is laying tax-free golden eggs. Let's do things that will keep the family in line. Okay, sharing of employees also has to be structured carefully. If the foundation and the family office are sharing a receptionist, for example, it may be difficult to allocate his or her time. The safest and best response is always to have the family office pay for these services and not to charge the foundation. If the employee's time can be allocated between the two entities, it is possible for the family office to employ the individual, with the foundation providing for the reimbursement. However, these services must constitute personal services, not secretarial. So as you know, secretarial immediately overrides this and throws off any attempt to get an exception. Okay, so promptly address misuse of foundation income and assets. The theme that we keep speaking about up to now is first identify and then act quickly to remedy. So family dynamics are an important factor. When these dynamics come into play, there can be liability for a director. So it's always important to enlist an outside advisor on your board who would be a professional who has experience in this area. Where there is misuse of a foundation income or assets, the board will need to reevaluate the policies to prevent the transaction from happening again. That is what we call subsequent remedial measures. Examples of misuse include the foundation purchasing fundraising tickets on behalf of a disqualified person, or a disqualified person displays the foundation artwork in their home or office. Very, very, it would seem that that would be easy to identify upfront, folks, but the answer here is, for example, and we'll talk more about this, the foundation is supporting a certain charity, and that charity has its annual dinner. And there are reasons how foundation board members could go to that dinner. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But maybe it's a night when it's the date night for the foundation board member and their spouse. And so, well, why don't you just come to this event? It should be a lovely evening and there'll be a great guest speaker and performers. Well, now the foundation is enriching family members when they're otherwise disqualified. So it is critical to understand this misuse of foundation income or assets. But when you find out this issue, correcting the act of self-dealing requires undoing the transaction to the extent possible. It may mean to cut a check directly to the charity event and having the charitable event cut a check back to the foundation. First and foremost, the board should marshal the facts, retain legal accountants and a forensic accountant, or at least have them on call, depending on the actual transgression. Investigating utilities or furniture purchases, having artwork, for example, that the foundation owns and now is in the home of one of the family members or one of the homes of actually one of the board members. Those are perfect examples of where you are abusing the IRS's wonderful gift of this tax-free entity. It may mean, for example, that if we found out 6 months later that one of the board members' families had the Andy Warhol out for the holiday season and at their home, maybe we would have to establish what would be a fair rent and have the family member enter into a retroactive agreement and have the foundation paid for the use of renting the Warhol during that period of time. Of course, counsel, we can help work that piece through. Avoid legally binding pledges, right? So an event can occur when a member of a board makes a personal pledge for a charitable donation. You go out to your child's school, and once again, their team is top 10 in the nation in football, and it's been a great weekend. And afterwards, one of the members of the development team pops over and says, hey, Charles, it is so great to see you here. We'd love to see you make a financial commitment. And then you did. And so at that point, if you have the foundation fulfill your requirement, then it would be considered self-dealing. It is a very, very nuanced piece. And so any commitment would be something that you would want clear from the university to say, it's wonderful to hear your interest as a board member of the Charles Thompson Family Foundation. We look forward to speaking with your board members and having you consider that. For the Charles individually to be able to have the credit and the benefit of making a gift of that amount, and then having the foundation pay it, begins to cross the line in an individual's mind, but has already blown through that line for the IRS's standpoint. So in an example here, Andrea joins the Family's Foundation. Andrea has been involved as an active alumnus. She has recently signed an legally binding pledge to make a personal gift to the university of $5,000. At the board meeting, her Family's Foundation, Andrea suggested that the foundation be directed to fulfill her pledge. This would be considered an act of self-dealing. Next, number six, protect the founder's mission. Many individuals establish their foundation with a specific purpose for the use of foundation assets through the use of the purpose clause in the foundation bylaws. A statement can be included to provide stringent interpretation of how the funds are being donated. This is an important piece, right? Because the people who have worked so hard to earn this money, each of you as the founders of your foundation and the primary donors, should continue to have the voice of the donations and to direct the donative intent. There often is what we call mission drift or charitable drift, where members of the foundation move off of the area that has been deemed to be the appropriate piece. It is critical, not that it impacts taxation, but that the foundation's ethos follows what was created by the original founder of the foundation, but otherwise by revisions by the members of the board of directors. That's why it's key to get the foundation up and running while you're healthy and alive and while you are at the helm of the foundation and build this donative pattern so that it is clear to both coming members and new members of the board what the direction of the foundation is. In the past month and a half, we've had some tragic crises in Texas and in Florida and in California and in Puerto Rico and certainly areas of the Caribbean. And our foundation members have stepped out of their typical restrictions on the charities they're giving and have made gifts to charities in these areas to support the people in need. The blessing here is that they have followed their own theory. So if there was a religious background or a spiritual background, or there was a certain orientation to helping the elderly or the nursing population or doctors or certain religious people, all of those are classic examples of where you can still follow your ethos in your charitable intent, but yet help those who have an immediate need. We used the example the other day of would you step over a homeless person as you were sprinting in your tuxedo to your favorite charity's black tie event? How does that jive with morality? It's a stark indication that we do want to honor our charitable interest and keep that ethos. At the same time, we want to always be respectful that there are many, many charities in need, and sometimes have an immediate need even more prominent than our charity that or charities that we're typically focusing on. That allows us to move into governance structures. So once the governance structure is in place, it's key to have outsiders or individuals who are not part of the family and serve so that you can create a majority on the board. It can also be specified that the foundation will terminate in the event the board tries to make a donation that is not in line with the original intent. We hope that that would never happen. The idea here is to threaten to use a hammer in the event that there is a need to push attack into the wall. The prayer here is that it makes it easy for the first person on the foundation board who has real questions about whether or not there's been a mission drift here, to be able to raise their hands and say, hey, folks, I think the conservative approach here is that if we make a gift outside of our charitable, outside the wishes of our mission statement, we could lose our both tax authority and tax exemption and also be forced to shut it down. It makes it easier on that group to do so. In the end, the hope is that we can continue to do great work and not have to let one or two specific instances get in the way of the overall great good work that the charities are doing. So others have said, look, they want their foundation to end after a certain period of time. I think there are multiple theories on that. There have been some great articles about people who've set a specific time period and said, now we're done, and just distribute the money out to the foundations. I am, and we as a firm have not become so dogmatic on that. In fact, our view is that the more that we can spread the goodwill, and in the next 2 weeks or so we'll be in the New York Times, because they've interviewed us on this idea of, and some of our foundation clients, on the idea of continuing to focus on charity. Why would you want to shut down the foundation unless you get to a point where the assets in the foundation it's no longer economic to run it? Then, of course, make the distributions. But otherwise, you're raising children and incorporating loved ones into your philosophy of doing good as you've done well in life. So having the final distributions out would be beyond what we would necessarily recommend at this point. Others say fold down the foundation after death. Our view on that is hang on. Wait before until we really get to see how well the foundation is performing while you're alive. Always seek legal advice. This is an easy one, of course. We're here for you. It's not unusual for many of you who have included us on your foundation as a board member to provide that crucial tiebreaker and to show that there is balance, also to keep you in compliance. More than anything, this call is about deeply appreciate the value of the foundation, but making sure that you stay in compliance. So number 8 is to exercise expenditure responsibly as we wrap up. And so be mindful that an excise tax of 20% is imposed on the foundation, which are classified as a taxable expenditure. If the foundation is making a contribution and does not want it to be treated as a taxable expenditure, it must ensure that it exercises expenditure responsibility. So we need to ensure that the grant is solely spent for the purpose of is intended. We must obtain reports from the grantee on how the funds were expended. These are the charities that we're writing checks on. Reporting such expenditures to the IRS on the 990PF, which each year we have to demonstrate to whom we've written the checks, and of course follow certain required steps in order to exercise responsibility, including a pre-grant inquiry or obtaining a written agreement from the grantee or recovering funds if they have not been used for the intended purpose. It would not be the first time or the last when we've been involved with a financial advisor and we've said the client has demonstrated disinterest in the types of charities they want to give. And the advisor says, here's 5. And, you know, next year, here's another 5. You know, let's not spend time and quote-unquote waste foundation assets. The answer here is that are we truly following the foundation's mission? Have we looked at each of these charities? What are their administrative expenses? What is their efficacy? What is their mission statement? What are the videos and the testimonials of people that have received benefits from these charities say about this charity? Are they matching what the intentions are directed all the way back up to our board members and to our original donors? So research should be done on each of the charities that you're writing checks out for. You have a special gift by the creation of this foundation. It started with you, with the gift that you made into the foundation. But now the compounding without tax and the idea that you can help others is truly special. So keep in mind the importance of making sure the charitable entities that you're giving to match the family philosophy. Okay, last is to identify any benefits from joint investments of co-ownership. So it is important to know that disqualified individuals may participate in a similar business proposition with the foundation. The IRS has indicated that joint investments could be inappropriately benefit the disqualified person because maybe there was a minimum investment, say, to participate in a certain fund. We often see $5 million minimums or more, and maybe the foundation would put in half and that the individual put in the other half, and that would enable the individual or the family office to participate in an investment that they otherwise were not able to. So depending on the facts, co-ownership of other types of property between the foundation and a disqualified person may be considered an act of self-dealing if the foundation's co-ownership confers this benefit. So be ultra careful on that. Come to us when you're looking to do a joint investment with your foundation or your family office or you individually because it's critical that we stay on track. We're all chasing yield. Yield, of course, in excess of the 5% because that's what check we're writing out each year or at minimum to these charities. So, but at what cost? Certainly not to the point where we would want to suffer penalties. So in finishing, use caution even with ticketing and fundraising events. We spoke before about the foundation cannot use a ticket to a charitable event as a free ticket because they've supported the foundation because then they're enriched. However, a trustee can attend a charitable event if he or she has the responsibility for evaluating and reviewing the activities of the foundation. I'm here to see what your event is about. Show us your stories that we want to hear. We're actively involved in the YMCA of Somerset County, so when there are annual events, it is a great time to see what this charity is doing in the community. So attending would be important, but having the foundation pay for your spouse would be a disallowed transaction. So in final, this is one of the best conference calls we do this year because it talks about giving back and helping those in need. And we want to continue to support you for your profound beneficence and your focus on those in need. This week alone, the charitable gifts and certain people that we have advised talk about the exhilaration they feel when they've been able to write out checks to people in need in Florida and Puerto Rico, and soon it will be in Northern California and, of course, Texas. There is a notion of completeness that you feel when you are giving out those assets, and so I finish by saying continue that great good work, and we're here to assist you.